The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
It's a Monday. Aren't Mondays fun? Or not? Well, welcome to it. Yes, Monday. It's a busy week, I can tell you that. Boy, do we have a lot going on today. First of all, today, former Congressman Dennis Kucinich is here. Now, I heard him a couple hours ago on with Tom Hartman. He'll spend a little more time with us, just because I put aside more time to spend with him. Dennis Kucinich is somebody that I've interviewed dozens of times over the years, although I looked back through my records and saw that it's been since February of 2012. That was the last time I spoke to him. Now, in 2012, Dennis Kucinich lost his seat in Congress, mostly due to gerrymandering, actually redistricting, right, where they combined his district along with Marcy Kaptur's. Basically, they rolled his district into hers, eliminating his seat. And I'm sure that was done on purpose. So Marcy Kaptur remained in the Senate. And I like Marcy Kaptur. The thing that I don't like about her is that, she and Dennis Kucinich, both practicing Catholics, I don't know if Dennis Kucinich is still a practicing Catholic, but they both come from that background and therefore are, I hate the terminology they use, what they call pro-choice, pro-life, which I call anti-choice. And Dennis Kucinich was always able to keep his personal views away from his responsibilities as an elected official representing the people who voted him into office. Marcy Kaptur, on the other hand, always bugged me that while she would vote, you know, with the Democrats, she would vote reasonably democratically on most issues. But when it came to matters of choice, she let her religion take precedent over the people that she was representing. And she would bring her religion into her work as a congresswoman. And that, I'm sorry, that's wrong. I believe that when you're elected, that you're elected to represent the people who voted for you, not to push your own personal beliefs and preferences. But that's just me. Anyway, can't find results for Nicole Sandler Live. What's going on? Are we all here? Everything good on YouTube? Looks okay. I don't know what Jan is saying, but we're here. We're here. So anyway, Dennis Kucinich has this new book out. I have not had a chance to read it because it just showed up yesterday. And as fast as I might read, I cannot make it through 548 pages or thereabouts, in a day. Or it came on Friday or Saturday. I just showed up is what I'm saying. So I looked through it. I know what it's about. And I actually knew this story because the story of the book, it's called The Division of Light and Power, doesn't have anything to do with his time in Congress. Instead, it deals with the 2 years he was mayor of Cleveland from 1977 to 79 when he stood up to the power base and the moneyed interests in Cleveland and stopped them from selling the publicly owned power company to private hands and was vindicated many years later. But Dennis Kucinich, I think, has always stood up for the little guy. And anyway, so I used to talk to him quite a bit back when he was, he was the real progressive in Congress, right? Before Alan Grayson showed up and said, let me tell you about the Republican health care plan, there was Dennis Kucinich, who was always advocating for a Department of Peace. And I'll tell you something, that's something that I still never forgot. I would much rather see a Department of Peace than a Department of War, which is now the Department of Defense. How about we go for the peace, right? So last time I spoke to him was in 2012, last time I saw him was in 2008 when he was running for the Democratic nomination for president. It was actually his second run for the nomination. In 2004, I was still not quite fully entrenched in the you know, when he was running in 2004, actually, in 2003, I was up in the Boston area doing music radio. And just when I first learned of Dennis Kucinich, because I was not a political animal back then, and there was like a contest that he had. He was a single guy, and there was a contest, you know, have dinner with Dennis Kucinich, and he was looking for a wife. Well, he didn't find his wife out of that contest. He got some press, because again, it was brought him to my attention. But years later, he wound up marrying his still wife, Elizabeth Kucinich. The Karate Joe, this will be a live interview. He's going to join us at the bottom of the hour on Zoom. So no, this is not pre-taped. But I'll tell you what, earlier today, so Dennis Kucinich is coming up. I thought, though, so when I last saw him in 2008, when he was in the primary, I was working then here in South Florida doing mornings on WINZ, which was then a progressive talk station owned by Clear Channel. It's now the fourth or fifth sports talk station in town. It has worse ratings than we had, by the way, so I guess they didn't care about that. But this photograph, if you're watching on one of the streams, this was at a Dennis Kucinich campaign event here in South Florida. That's me. And that's Allison. She, I guess, if this was 2008, she was about eight or nine years old. So, yeah. So that's the last time I saw Dennis Kucinich. So we will, you know, we won't be in person, but he will be on the Zoom. So we will see one another, and we'll pick up right where we left off. I do have a few questions for him, which is a good thing because I'm going to be interviewing him in a little while. Now, tomorrow, Laffy will be here because she's back. Yes. And on Wednesday, an interview that I've been working to get for a while. And the reason it's taken so long is because, well, Ari Berman has been busy. Ari Berman these days writes for Mother Jones magazine. But for years, his beat has been voting rights. And in fact, the book he wrote about 5 years ago, Bring Us the Ballot, I think it was what it was called, is still relevant. And it you know, it gets worse. So he's been crazy busy, obviously, given what's happening in our world. And he has the cover story right now at Mother Jones in the current issue. And let me see if I can find the title. Well, whatever. I will post it for you. Anyway, I recorded an interview with Ari Berman this morning that will play back on Wednesday because, oh my goodness, we're in the midst of it. And one of the things that we talked about was obviously, you know, what brought us to this point, the history behind the Jim Crow laws, which he likens what's going on today to. But you know, it always brings us back to Joe Manchin. Senator Joe Manchin has a stick up his ass, and I'm not quite sure where it's from. I guess maybe the fact that he is a, you know, allegedly a Democrat in a very, very Republican state. But the things that he says makes no sense at all. For instance, yesterday, Chris Wallace interviewed Joe Manchin. Yes, Joe Manchin was on Fox News Sunday. And even Chris Wallace gets that Joe Manchin has his facts all fucked up. And I'm not going to play the whole thing for you, but after they had gotten into it for about 5 minutes, Chris Wallace finally says, "Aren't you naive?" Yes, he is.
Senator McConnell, the head of the Republicans in the Senate, says that he's 100% focused on blocking the Biden agenda. Question, aren't you being naive, yes, about this continuing talk about bipartisan cooperation?
Yeah.
I'm not being naive. I think he's 100% wrong in trying, geez, to block all the good things that we're trying to do for America. We'd be a lot better if we had participation. And we're getting participation. But when it comes time to final vote, I disagree with Leader McConnell on this, a minority leader on this issue, that he puts politics before the policies that I think we need for our country. I'm going to continue to keep working with my bipartisan friends, and hopefully we can get more of them. I can tell you this, in 2013, at that time, Harry Reid, the leader of the majority party, the Democrats, right, basically, the nuclear option, which did away the filibuster on appointments and district and circuit judges. Comebacks 2017, then we had Leader McConnell at that time in the majority, and he did away with it for the Supreme Court. So what goes around comes around here. They all understand that. And there were 33 Democrats in 2017 that signed a letter to please save the filibuster and save our democracy. That's what I'm trying to do.
Okay. Saving our filibuster and saving our democracy are two diametrically opposed ideas. In fact, Douglas Brinkley is a presidential historian. He had a few words to say on the subject.
Oh, you have to strong arm them. I mean, Lyndon Johnson would do the lean in treatment and stare you down and make your life miserable for you. You have to have discipline. Manchin has become a media star as being the guy who holds the Democratic Party in the balance. It's unfortunate. You would think at this point he would get behind the fact that the Republican Party is gerrymandering, trying to disenfranchise voters. But alas, he wants to be seen as the maverick of West Virginia on issues of voting rights, which has a lot to do with race. Manchin isn't a progressive. He's more worried about his future in West Virginia politics than he is helping the Biden administration succeed. So the filibuster looks like it's here to stay. Any hope is going out the window with Manchin's wiping his hands and saying, I'm going to leave the filibuster alone.
So really quickly, you're saying this is about Manchin wanting to stay in power. Now, as we know, Senator Manchin has said, no, this is about protecting the Senate and the institution. What
nonsense.
Do you think
all that?
I think that that's baloney.
Or
Manchin is looking after his own hide here. We're in a very divided country, and for Biden to have a setback like this simply because of somebody that caucuses, you know, is with the, part of the Democratic Party, it's unfortunate. And I think Biden should call Manchin out by name instead of doing, low ebb kind of, you know, there's somebody that's causing a problem. Voting rights now are being threatened in the United States, and Republicans are scoring a big victory because of a Democrat from West Virginia.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I look forward to playing for you the interview with Ari Berman. Before, you know, as I was getting ready to talk to him and seething about this nonsense from not only Joe Manchin, but Kyrsten Sinema. My God, she still hasn't answered where the hell she was the day that the Senate voted on the creation of a January 6th commission. But I listened again to the last couple of minutes of the maiden Senate address by newly elected Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia. You see, one of the things that made the heads explode of the Republicans like Brian Kemp and Raffensperger and the people in Georgia and the Republican Party writ large was the fact that on January 5th, in the special election, just the day before the Capitol insurrection, on January 5th, those two special elections in Georgia were decided, both in favor of the Democrats. And the Democrats in this case happened to be one black man and one Jewish man. Go figure. They didn't like that much. And again, I will post the Ari Berman piece. It's called, I think I closed that window. Let me see if I have it here. It's a cover story from the new issue of Mother Jones. I will post it on the blog. It's about Jim Crow laws rearing their ugly heads again. So you can read it in advance of the interview. But I read that, and then I just had to go back and listen to this. This is the last couple of minutes of Raphael Warnock's first speech on the floor of the U.S. Senate. And, just listen to him.
Surely there ought to be at least 60 in this chamber who believe, as I do, that the four most powerful words uttered in a democracy are "the people have spoken. Therefore, we must ensure that all of the people can speak. But if not, we must still pass voting rights. The right to vote is preservative of all other rights. It is not just another issue alongside other issues. It is foundational. It is a reason why any of us has the privilege of standing here in the first place. It is about the covenant we have with one another as an American people. E pluribus unum, out of many one. It above all else must be protected. And so as I close, and nobody believes a preacher when he says, as I close, let me say that I, as a man of faith, I believe that democracy is the political enactment of a spiritual idea. The sacred worth of all human beings. The notion that we all have within us a spark of the divine and a right to participate in the shaping of our destiny. John Lewis understood that and was beaten on a bridge defending it.
Yeah, he was.
Amelia Boynton, like so many women not mentioned nearly enough, was gassed on that same bridge. A white woman named Viola Luiso was killed. Mega Evers was murdered in his own driveway. Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, two Jews and an African-American standing up for that sacred idea of democracy, also paid the ultimate price. And we in this body would be stopped and stymied by partisan politics, short-term political gain, Senate procedure?
Yeah.
I say let's get this done no matter what. I urge my colleagues to pass these two bills, strengthen and lengthen the cords of our democracy, secure our credibility as the premier voice for freedom-loving people and democratic movements all over the world, and win the future for all of our children. Mr. President, I yield the floor.
And I'm letting this play because let me ask you, when is the last time you heard that reaction, that reaction to a Senate floor speech? Usually when a senator gets up and delivers a speech, they're the only one there. Nobody sticks around and listens anymore. The C-SPAN cameras are there to capture it. And whoever is the presiding officer, the president of the Senate that day, is there, and the staffers, you know, they're there, and maybe a couple of people in the gallery, but that's it. But when Raphael Warnock was giving his maiden address on the floor of the Senate, people showed up because this was historic, and what he had to say was so important. The fact that the state of Georgia elected a black man and a Jewish man at the very same time that the Republican Party is trying to undo the rights of us to vote, is a statement. And it's a statement that the Republicans don't like. And that's why they're doing what they're doing now. There is, look, I don't often quote Jennifer Rubin. There was a time there that when she first, you know, when the whole Never Trumper thing started, and there was this right-wing columnist for the Washington Post, who I never, you know, gave the time of day to, who all of a sudden was saying things that made sense. And I've gone this whole circle with Jennifer Rubin. There was a time I couldn't just not stand her anymore because of the whole Never Trumper hypocrisy of it. But some of the things she's saying is just, you know what? It's interesting that it is a Republican or a reformed Republican saying these things. And in today's Washington Post, she has a column. The headline reads, "Time to Call Manchin's Bluff." And she said, I won't read the whole thing, but here's part of it. Senator Joe Manchin declared in a Sunday op-ed that he is against the For the People Act because it is not bipartisan. I believe that partisan voting legislation will destroy the already weakening binds of our democracy, and for that reason, I will vote against the For the People Act, he wrote. Furthermore, I will not vote to weaken or eliminate the filibuster. Well, he's an idiot, because I can play these clips over and over again, like this one.
Would you be willing to break the filibuster in order to get this passed?
I'm not ready to destroy our government.
He's not ready to destroy our government. No, he's just willing to stand by and be complicit while the Republicans do it. Or this one.
It's basically designed to make sure the minority has input. That's exactly our founding fathers.
No, what?
And
no.
Now, if you want to make it.
No, and I just, it's not the founding fathers, because the goddamn filibuster is nowhere in the Constitution. He doesn't know what he's talking about. So Jennifer Rubin goes on. She said, let's take H.R. 1 first. That's also S1. That's the For the People Act. He does not state what provisions he likes or doesn't, nor does he suggest what compromise bill might reach 60 votes. So his objection is that the Republicans object? Many bills that he supported came without Republican support. The American Rescue Plan most recently, and of course the Affordable Care Act. The notion that Republicans win simply by refusing to agree to any of the majority's legislative proposals makes a mockery of democracy, and specifically of the Senate. Indeed, Republicans' filibuster of the January 6th commission legislation showed that we lack 10 Republicans willing to operate in good faith. You think? It goes on like that. Manchin also states that he prefers H.R. 4, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which addresses only reauthorization of pre-clearance provisions. So it doesn't go far enough. Again, I'm blasting through this Jennifer Rubin editorial so that you get the gist of it. I will post a link to it on the blog where I post the show today at NicoleSandler.com/6-7-21. She goes on. She says, it's time for Manchin to put up or share blame for Republicans' diversion of democracy, subversion of democracy. Let him come up with 10 Republicans for H.R. 4 and for a slimmed down H.R. 1. Let him find four more Republicans to support the January 6th commission. If he cannot, then his thesis that the filibuster promotes debate and makes way for compromise collapses, and his role in promoting the tyranny of the minority is laid bare. See what I'm talking about? Yeah, he doesn't have a clue. Same way Kyrsten Sinema does not know what the filibuster is about. Her, you know, maybe she was absent that day at school. I'm being generous here. But she doesn't have a clue either. Here's Kyrsten Sinema. I know I played this last week, and I labeled this clip. if you're watching on video, I labeled it Kyrsten Sinema Idiot Explains the Filibuster. Here's what she said.
Well, as folks in Arizona know, I've long been a supporter of the filibuster because it is a tool that protects democracy of our nation. Rather than allowing our country to ricochet wildly every 2 to 4 years back and forth between policies.
It protects nothing.
The idea of the filibuster was created by those who came before us, the United States Senate.
But those who came before us, not the founders.
To encourage senators to find bipartisanship and work together.
Bullshit! It has nothing to do with finding bipartisanship. It just gives the minority power over the majority. And that's not what it's supposed to be about. That's not what it's about. That's not how democracy works. So I don't know if you remember, but a few months back when we were first talking about we need to eliminate the filibuster, Norm Ornstein was on the show because he had written an article and had a great plan for bringing back the talking filibuster with a few slight changes that would put the onus on the minority party to keep the debate going, or basically to stop the bill from coming up for a vote. It would put the onus on the minority. Right now, the minority doesn't have to do anything. They don't have to talk. They don't have to do a talking filibuster. They just have to not allow 60 votes. They have to not allow, in this case, 10 of their members to vote with the Democrats. Norm Ornstein said, you know what, we got to change that. Well, Today, I just noticed he was on Twitter. He has a long thread on Twitter. Let me share with you what he wrote, because this is really smart. He said, I knew Robert Byrd well. And Robert Byrd is the guy who that Joe Manchin's always talking about. He doesn't want to upset what Robert Byrd would have wanted, who was, you know, insistent on the filibuster in a sense. Let me share with you the Twitter thread. He wrote, I knew Robert Byrd well. Testified in front of him on the filibuster and the Rules Committee. Talked to him one-on-one about the Senate and its rules. He had a very different attitude by 2009 than he had in 1975, as did the Republicans in the Senate. A supermajority then, in both parties, wanted to work on a compromise. Different now. When he was wheeled into the chamber from his deathbed to provide the 60th vote on the Affordable Care Act, he was angrier than I've ever seen him, shaking his fist and shouting, shame, shame, at Mitch McConnell. As leader, he regularly looked for workarounds, sometimes pretty impressively devious, to make the majority have its say, including against nemesis like James Allen. He did not believe the rules were cast in stone. If he were here today, seeing what McConnell has done with filibusters, with Supreme Court nominations and confirmations, and the obdurate obstruction of Republicans, a move to 55 present and voting, done the only way possible, would have his support. I am certain of that. So I saw that thread and I tweeted to Norm, Norm, have you tried talking to Manchin? Somebody's got to talk some sense into that man. And he responded to me, and he said, I am hoping to do so. Not that, you know, Norm Ornstein will be able to, but we need an intervention of sorts. Somebody, a few people, need to take Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and any other senators who might be mischaracterizing what the filibuster is, and to, first of all, give them a little bit of a history lesson and then have a come to Jesus meeting with them. Because we need to change it. If not, we're just fucked and not in a good way, really. All right. Dennis Kucinich is coming up. I think before he gets here, we could use a little bit of levity. What do you think? So what we're going to do, I think this is the right one, it is. We're going to turn things over to our friend, Lauren Mayer, for a little song while we await the arrival of Dennis Kucinich. All right, take it away, Lauren Mayer.
Why our country has problems rooted in history. I don't want to know that everyone's not happy as long as things are good for me. I don't want to know about critical race theory. In fact, I think it deserves a ban. Can't we just go back to like 1950 when it was great if you were white, Christian, straight, and a man? Oops, don't give me facts now. Truth is upsetting. I won't listen to your bad news on injustice and stuff. Trying to believe that there's no more discrimination, at least for people who look like me. Project. It's complicated and hard to understand. I don't want to know about anything. Honey, I'll just keep my head in the sand. I don't want to know about that insurrection. It was just tourists. Can't we move on? If what I believe needs any correction, I'll get my answers from QAnon. The truth is depressing. Spoils my fun. You can tell me that I'm crazy, but I'm not the only one. Trying to ignore things. Oh, yes, I'm nutty and I don't know any I'd rather float around cluelessly. I won't notice problems if I'm not going through them. Isn't it all about me? La 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 la. I can't hear you. La 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 la. No, really, I can't hear you.
Lauren Mayer with a song parody, I Don't Want to Know, characterizing some politicians today who just don't want to know. They just don't want to know. All right. I am Nicole Sandler, and I'm very excited to welcome our next guest because it's been a long time since we've spoken. Congressman Dennis Kucinich, welcome back to the program. Hi there.
Thank you very much, Nicole. It's good to be with you again. It's been a while.
It's been a long time. In fact, I pulled out a couple of photos from the last time I saw you, which I believe was 2008. And I had my little daughter with me, who at the time is now 22, but at the time was about 8 or 9 years old. So there she is biting my hand. If you can see that, and we did take another picture together that was a little nicer. So where she actually stood still, and so you were down here in Florida campaigning, hoping to win the Democratic nomination for the 2008 presidential election.
Right.
So it has been a while. And then we spoke throughout the years during the days I was on Air America Radio, and I looked back through my stuff, and it seems like the last time we spoke was 2012, and that was your last year in Congress, right?
That was my last year. Well, I finished my term on January the 3rd, 2013.
Right. Well, it is nice to see you and nice to hear from you again. And the reason that you're here today is your new book. It's actually officially out tomorrow, but available for sale. It's called The Division of Light and Power. And when I first saw it, I thought, oh, I guess it's like a spiritual thing, because I had forgotten the story of your time as mayor of Cleveland. And that's what this book is all about. It's a big book covering a 2-year stretch. But why don't you tell us the basic story of what you tell in the book in much more detail?
Right. Well, it's a book not only for yesterday's Cleveland, but the context of it is relevant for today. This is about corporate espionage and corporate sabotage and price fixing and an attempt to usurp a municipal government by interest groups who have their own narrow concerns and not the broad-based concerns of the people. It's about a relentless effort to try to steal from the people of Cleveland their municipal electric system, and about the role that I played as a councilman and later on as mayor to stop that from happening, and the consequences that came as a result of that involved dealing with organized crime, assassination plots. I mean, this book has it all, and it's nice to be able to talk about it retrospectively. But the core of the book raises the question about who's making the decisions in any community. Who's in charge? I say City Hall is not just a building on 6th and Lakeside in Cleveland. It's the boardroom of the banks, the real estate combines, utility monopolies, and the mob. And every city has their own centers of power, but people aren't always aware of it. So this book is really a tutorial on government and how to understand the different layers that are there and how to access levers of power.
Yes. And in fact, the prologue is wonderful. It's just 2 short paragraphs. If you don't mind, I want to read it. You wrote,
please do.
People who say you can't fight City Hall don't know where it is. You have to find it before you can fight it. City Hall was not only the Doric gray temple, stone temple on East 6th and Lakeside Avenue in downtown Cleveland. City Hall was the boardroom of Cleveland's banks, its investor-owned utilities, its real estate combines, and the mob. In Cleveland, City Hall was in the shadows, a giant specter invisible to the people of the city. I brought the invisible City Hall to light, with great consequences for my city, my family, my friends, and myself. I was the mayor, and I fought City Hall. I see that as the opening to the movie. So have the movie rights been optioned yet?
I've had people express interest, but, you know, right now I'm just focused on calling attention to the book.
Gotcha.
You know, it's written in a way, you know, the way that I write, I try to be as descriptive as possible and bring the reader right into the action and then move along with me through it. And everything in the book, Nicole, is documented. I spent a considerable amount of time making sure that every claim that was in there can be backed up by several sources.
And you've got them all here. It's all, I mean, the whole back end of the book. I mean, the book is, it's 600 and what I'm looking at, 58 pages or so. But you start with the end notes at 568, and that's after your glossary. So this is well documented and footnoted.
Well, I also want to say that as a means of trying to help the reader get more information, for those who buy the book, they'll have access to the Division of Light and Power Archives, which has the entire federal filings, the antitrust case filings, and, you know, thousands of more pages that wouldn't have been practical to put into the book itself.
Now, I got to ask you, so you left the office of mayor of Cleveland in 1979. That's over 40 years ago. Why just come out with this book now?
Because it took me 40 years to write. Really? I mean, I tried to write it immediately, but I was too close to the story.
Oh.
And, you know, and I, and in the early 80s, by the way, I had a meeting with Marty Bregman, who did Serpico and Al Pacino for, you know, 4 hours in New York City.
Right.
And they wanted to do a movie. But I was too close to it to try to describe what happened. And over the years, I've made one try after another. The book that you have there represents the seventh draft.
Wow.
So you know, I mean, I would write something, wasn't satisfied with it, just start over. And yeah, it took me years to be able to get to that point. And then once I was satisfied, then I had to, at the same time, do all the documentation, which took quite a while as well. So, yeah, this is the product of many, many years of work. When I was in Congress, I set it aside. And when I left Congress, I started on it. And in 2018, it was a 3-year sprint. And finally,
here you are. Here you are. Well, Dennis, I was actually telling the listeners, the first time I heard of you was before I got into talk radio, into political talk radio. I did music radio, and I was working at a station in Boston, and a story, this was 2004. So it was your first presidential run, and a story crossed the wire of you were, you know, running, and there was a contest for a woman to have dinner with you, to meet a day. And you, that stuck with me all these years. And then of course, many years later, you married your current wife, Elizabeth, who is just an amazing woman from all we know. But funny that that's my first memory of you. That has nothing to do with politics, but that contest.
It's interesting because I started that campaign as a bachelor. And, you know, when I met Elizabeth, that campaign was over. And I was actually not expecting to be with anybody. But, you know, I was looking, but, you know, a national campaign really isn't the right time to find.
No, love, you right?
With. Not. But then, you know, 2005, I met Elizabeth. I had a friend of mine, Ravi Shankar. Ravi Shankar.
Of course.
I saw him. He visited Washington. I saw him. I said, hey, you know, I've been looking to have somebody in my life. And, you know, I looked all over the country. I haven't found her. His response was, stop looking and she will appear. So I said, okay, I'll do that. And that afternoon, Elizabeth walked through the door.
Wow. And many years later, you guys are still going strong. Yes.
We are.
Knock on wood, laminate here. Good for you. So in the years since you left Congress, 2013, January of 2013, your term ended. We didn't hear much from you. And maybe that's because you signed on to Fox as a contributor. My television just doesn't go there. Few times I've tried, I, you know, if I keep it on, I'm going to wind up breaking the TV and I can't afford a new one. So, We keep losing our connection. I think we lost your camera. But Dennis, you're still with us. There you are. So what made you decide to go to Fox? Was it to talk some sense into them, or what was that experience like?
It was a good experience because I was asked to join Fox by Roger Ailes.
Okay.
And Roger called me and he says, we have nothing in common. But he said, I think you're honest. And I think that it's important to have your point of view on our network. And one incident that happened, like early on, I've never told this before, but it's worth repeating. One of my first shows, I had a guy on who red baited me, okay? And Ailes found out about it, and he basically read everybody the Riot Act. You know, he basically said this happens again and there's, you know, people are going to be out of here. So he really felt very strongly about the importance of the voice that I presented, which was different than the rest of the Fox family. And I was treated with respect there.
Were you?
And people listened to what I had to say. And not once did anybody ever suggest to me, well, you know, you should say this or that. That never happened. I had total freedom with whatever I wanted to say. And it couldn't have been any other way, but it's noteworthy that I did.
Right. But were you, and again, I apologize because I didn't see any of your segments there. Were you on with the likes of Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity? And I mean, I
know every one of those individuals who's right. on the show, you know, and sometimes we went at it. But I was there to present my view, not to parrot anyone else.
Sure.
And so whoever I was on with, whether it was Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly or Karl Rove or any of the people who were on the show, we presented our different views, and I mm-hmm. was very firm about the position that I took on things. And it was always respectful. And let me just say something, Nicole. You know, if you don't reach out to people, how do you change their minds?
Right.
If people aren't exposed to different points of view, nothing changes. And I'm not into a polarized thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my book, by the way, the book that I've written represents a very straightforward story without embellishment, without trying to. It's not about left or right.
No, this is not that at all. This is not about partisan politics. This is about right and wrong.
Right. Thank you. That's exactly mm-hmm. that's exactly right. And so I'm, and it's important to have mutual respect with people. You have to establish that.
I couldn't agree more. Right.
You know, once you establish a mutuality there, then you build trust. And you know, I think it's possible to have diametrically opposed views from somebody, but still be able to have communication with them.
Sure.
And not shut them down and they not shut you down. Now, it's a little bit tougher these days, it
right.
seems.
Okay.
But I tried to steer that path when I was on.
Right. And I don't disagree with going on there. You know, some people on the left freaked out when Bernie Sanders did a town hall with Fox. I think it's great. Let them hear what we're thinking. The problem I have is the lack of respect that I see coming back from them. And today I can't see Tucker Carlson giving you the same kind of maybe respect that you got from some of the people you dealt with a few years back.
Well, I will say this, you know, I mean, I haven't been on a show in years, but I don't have any doubt at all. If I was invited on, I'd be treated with respect. Hmm. I mean, he and I have known each other. It's not like we have different points of view, mm-hmm. and it's important to start out with that respect. And then you talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Right.
I don't have any problem there.
Oh, good.
I mean, to me, again, you know, this book is really about how someone can take a stand on behalf of the people without entering into discussion about who's a Democrat, who's a Republican, mm-hmm. who's liberal, who's conservative. You said it a moment ago. It's about right or wrong.
That's right.
And that's kind of the territory that I, you know, stake, stake my claim on for the Division of Light and Power.
Great. I'm going to give you a song to listen to. It's many, many years old. It's by an artist named Joe Jackson. I used to use it as my theme song, but because I'm on YouTube and stuff, I can't play music anymore because they copyright violate me. But it's called Right and Wrong. And it's about that. He says, I'm not talking about right and left. I'm talking about right and wrong. You would love it. So you should go check it out. Joe Jackson, Right and Wrong. It's kind of an obscure song, but it's great. So
you can't play it now.
I can't play it now because I'd get copyright violated. Because I miss having you in Congress because you were, you know, here I'm going to go with the left-right thing again, but you were decidedly further to the left than most of even the Democratic caucus. I mentioned this earlier when I said you were coming on. You used to talk a lot about the need for a Department of Peace instead right. of, you know, what it used to be the Department of War, now the Department of Defense. Why don't we think in those terms? I would love someone to get on the subject of media because it's so fragmented now. Back in the old days when I started in radio, there was no such thing as conservative talk radio and progressive talk radio. There was talk radio and you would hear all the voices on the same station. So you would get exposed to it all. And guess what? Both sides would talk to each other. It doesn't happen anymore.
Well, let me go back to the book. Yep. When I was elected mayor, mm-hmm. I defeated both the Democratic and the Republican parties. And that was no small matter because the Democrats had a real machine mm-hmm. and Republicans had a lot of, you know, establishment institutional support. But the independent path that I have taken is as an independent thinker. Now, somebody can say, well, you know, Washington Post wrote a few years ago, they said that what I represented was the future of American politics. And I hope that's true. I hope that people can take positions without respect to a political party, can do what they feel is right for the American people without having to score partisan points. Because frankly, I can't, to me, the idea that there's only one way of looking at the world mm-hmm. and you got to see it through a partisan lens, come on. I mean, that never made sense to me, ever.
Well, you know, I always say I'd be happy to debate a Republican, somebody who has a diametrically opposed viewpoint. The problem, though, today in 2021 is, you know, the lies. I mean, they're lying about everything. Going back to the last election, everything. And, you know, there have to be ground rules for any debate where you have to stipulate to the facts. They won't stipulate to the fact that the sky is blue and the grass is green. So I can't have an intelligent conversation with anybody who won't agree on the basic facts. They're still insisting that the election was stolen. I mean, how do you deal with something like that?
Well, I think it's important to be able to know why people think that way. I you know, I have my own ideas about elections. So one of the things in my own book, at the beginning of the book, I talk about how an election, my first, when I was elected in 69, how that election was almost stolen. Hmm. So elections can be stolen.
Oh, they can be.
I think that, you know, you're right. We have to try to establish a common ground of meaning.
Yes.
And where you start, you start with mutual respect and then you build the trust. And then you start talking and we need to talk to each other, not past each other. You know, I have the same sense of, I feel the same sense of pain that you do about things are so polarized today that it's difficult to have any communication. And yet the country cannot exist without people talking to one another. And we're really in a quandary right now. Yeah. And one of the things that I hope my book will do is to be able to show that, you know, government can work, what the interest groups are, whether it's a Democrat or Republican in charge, and how citizens can get their voices heard and create an opening and enter into the discussion. Because those who are holding office are not the only ones entitled to a point of view about current events.
No.
And so I've in the book, I have many examples of standing up and speaking out when, you know, not by invitation, because if you're going to get involved, you can't wait to be invited. That's one of the messages. Mm-hmm. And be ready and know what you're talking about and be ready to stand up and speak out without regard to political party, ideology, or anything like that. So, you know, the book is essentially a non-ideological book, if that's possible. It is not partisan.
Right.
The division of light and power is about crony capitalism on one level. It's about it's about some elemental positions about what's right and what's not.
Right. Now, all the officials in Ohio and everybody in retrospect looks back on your standing up to this, you know, the desire they wanted to sell this public service to a private company. They wanted to privatize it. And you, as the youngest mayor of a major city, you said no. And you really stood your ground and didn't let it happen. And they fought you at the time. Now they're all applauding you for it, going, that was so great. It was the right thing to do. But I guess they weren't there at the time. Now, in 79, when you left office, was that by choice? Or were you voted out?
No, what happened. You know, the people of Cleveland, I went to them in December of 1978, and I said, look, I basically had to deal with the banks. The banks said that if the people passed an income tax, they would take the city out of default. We'd use the money to pay off the defaulted notes on loans I hadn't even taken out. They were taken out by my Republican predecessor. Mm. So the banks said, okay, you go along with that. I then decided with the help of my then wife that I would take the issue of Muni Light to the people and put that on the ballot. So no one thought we had a chance to win this, but long story short, we passed the tax to mm-hmm. pay off the defaulted note so we could get out of default. And we passed the Muni Light issue by a margin of 2-1 that was beyond anyone's understanding. Well, guess what happened? The banks reneged on their promise to take the city out of default. They kept the city into default until I left office. And they and the utility and the business establishment continued to demand that I sell an electric system that the people approved keeping by a 2-1 margin.
Wow.
I mean, this is the level of corruption that existed at this time is beyond what anyone.
And so is it still there? Is it? Oh no. And we lost Dennis. Let's see if he comes back because I do have other questions for him. I was fearing that was going to happen because his video kept cutting out. Oh, I hope he comes back in because I want to ask him a few other questions. I want to ask him, one, is he running for mayor again? Because I believe he filed the paperwork before the end of last year to run for mayor of Cleveland again. So that's one thing I want to ask him about. And I also, God, we didn't even, I was going to take him gently back into his time at Fox, because I understand he kind of applauded Donald Trump's inauguration speech. Remember the what was it? The doom and gloom, whatever, you know, it was horrible. And then he was against the impeachment, at least the first one. So I don't know. And I'm bummed because he doesn't appear to be coming back. That is Dennis Kucinich, and it's interesting to hear him be nonpartisan because he was very, in fact, it wasn't so much partisan. He was just very far to the left of anybody, certainly in the Republican Party, but also in the Democratic Party. So, layers of corruption. All right. It appears that we have lost Dennis Kucinich. What? American Carnage. That's what it was. Thank you. It was the American Carnage speech. And seriously, I read somewhere that he congratulated him. He thought it was a great speech. Oh, he's back. Yay. Okay. It looks like, we'll give him a second here. It looks like Dennis is back. You're back with us. I'm so excited. I thought we had lost you. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you.
So what I was going to ask you next is, we're talking about your time as mayor of Cleveland. Are you running again?
Well, there's talk to that effect, but I haven't really announced anything. And, you know, it's a little bit early to do that. I'm first trying to get this book out.
Gotcha.
The one thing I want to make clear, Nicole, is, you know, some people are saying, well, is this a campaign book? Yeah, maybe for 1980.
Right.
You know, you can't plan. I didn't know when I'd finish the book. It took me years to be able to finish it. So there is a filing deadline coming up on the 16th of June.
Mm-hmm.
And all I can tell you, Nicole, is just stay tuned.
Okay. Because I thought I read somewhere that you did the initial filing of the paperwork in December.
You did read that. It was to file a committee to receive money. But
okay.
You have to do that to be able to raise funds. But that's different than actually filing petitions to run. You need 3,000 good signatures. And the filing deadline is on the 16th of June. And again, thanks for asking. Please stay tuned.
Okay. So I'll leave it there and maybe we can reconnect. Now I got to ask you another question. I also read that you, after Donald Trump's inauguration, that you congratulated him on the American Carnage speech. Is that, did you thought that was a good speech?
No, I congratulated him for taking a stand on behalf of fair trade. You have to remember that in Cleveland, our industries here have been wiped out by NAFTA and by China trade.
Mm-hmm.
And the president, you know, and I think that whoever becomes the president should be accorded a chance to do something for the country.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, every president, Democrat or Republican who's been elected in my time, I've sent congratulatory notes over. That doesn't, you know, I did the same thing for George Bush and I put articles of impeachment up on
yes,
him.
You so, very famously. So yes, you
not
did.
Not like I'm, you know, going to be a sucker for anything mm-hmm. that comes down the pike. So I did it as a gesture of goodwill. I mean, you know, America has to try to bind up the country's wounds.
Right.
And if you don't do that, we remain forever divided. And I do think it's true that a house divided against itself cannot stand. And right now,
we are
divided against ourselves. And I'm not, you know, that's not the territory that I want to do my work in, to dwell in. I want to try to see how you can bring people together. But I have never failed to challenge anybody who's, you know, if they were doing something that I didn't agree with.
Right.
And, you know, that's a Democrat or Republican.
Right. Did you oppose? I mean, you even brought up you did file impeachment articles against George W. Bush. Were you against the impeachment of Donald Trump?
Look, I think every president has to be held accountable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to me, you know, look, especially when you're a member of Congress, you're co-equal branch of government.
Right.
You can't, you know, we don't elect kings. Every president must be held accountable. And it was not personal. I'll tell you mm-hmm. a story. You know, I was in Congress and, you know, a few months after the impeachment, George Bush walked past me speaking, you know, so addressing the Congress, came by me and I leaned over and I said something to him. He stopped in his tracks and he turned back towards me and says, well, what'd you say, Dennis? And I said, Mr. President, I wish you peace.
Nice.
If you can't address the humanity of another person,
mm-hmm.
can't, and his composure changed dramatically. And he said, you know, he said, thank you, Dennis. He says, I know that you mean that. And I did. And so, you know, if it's all about trying to get partisan advantage and, you know, taking a sword out and running it through a guy, oh, how dismal that is. And so even George Bush, who, yes, I put up articles of impeachment, stood on the floor of the House 4.5 hours reading those articles.
I remember.
And you know, at the same time, that was my obligation as a member of Congress to stand up for the Constitution.
Right.
But it was not personal. I mean, I actually had a pretty good relationship with him until that time.
Gotcha. But the question I was asking is, you don't think that Donald Trump was, I mean, deserved to be impeached?
The way the Trump administration operated isn't anything I would agree with. I would have probably spent a lot of time on the floor of the House challenging them one day after the other. But
You weren't.
If
there.
I did it, it wouldn't be as a partisan.
Right. Gotcha.
It would be as someone who loves America and says, well, let's try this approach. I'm not interested in beating people up. You know, it's like, defend the Constitution, do what's right for the American people, and don't worry if you're going to work with Democrats or Republicans, because America has to be able to work together. I would often tell my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, I point to the American eagle above the chambers of the House of Representatives. I said, you see that eagle? It needs two wings to fly. And America cannot operate just from one partisan perspective. And it's very difficult now to negotiate that territory because there is so much partisan hostility and rancor. But the thing that I've always tried to do is to find a way to address people at a personal level, to find what our commonalities are, and then see if we might come to an agreement on something. And as a result, I was able to work with people on both sides of the aisle, and sometimes it had a real powerful impact.
How about coming back to Congress to try to negotiate peace? Because it's kind of ugly right now.
I'll tell you, I've talked to my friends on both sides of the aisle, and they're really dispirited. They're saddened.
I'll bet.
By the constant bombardment back and forth.
That's horrible.
Look, you can't, you know, we're all Americans and we shouldn't forget that. I mean, if we're united by love of country, then let us be united in that love of country and find that that's a good place to start.
Yep.
You know,
most
we're
definitely.
One family, and when we forget that and we treat each other as enemies, oh my, we're fracturing our country.
Yeah, we are. And that's where we are now.
And I, you know, the book is a straightforward approach to how we can navigate territory when these corporate interests are playing people off against each other, and how important it is to take a stand when that happens.
Got it.
I mean, I think anybody who reads the book is going to be shocked at what happened back then, but what's passed is prologue. Mm-hmm. If you look, there's other things that are going on in every city. The centers of power, people are not always aware of who makes the decisions. They take for granted it's the person sitting in that mayor's chair. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily so.
Right. The book is The Division of Light and Power, Dennis J. Kucinich. It is available now, officially out tomorrow. Dennis, it's so nice to see you again. Thank you for joining us. And I hope if you do decide to run stay in the public eye that you'll come back and visit with us again.
Well, you know, I'd like to, in any event, do that, Nicole.
I would love that.
Thanks for paying such careful attention to these themes. And, you know, I'm hopeful our country's going to get through this time without any more damage. But
you and me both. You and me both. Dennis Kucinich, thank you again. It was great talking to you.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye. And with that, we're done. That's a Monday show for you. Tomorrow's Tuesday, Gotta Laugh will be here. Don't forget Wednesday, Ari Berman. Thursday, Cory Doctorow and Harry Klein. And then on Friday, we have something special coming up. We're gonna go back to my past. Oh, it looks like YouTube is cutting out on us. On Friday, I'm gonna be joined by Mark Thompson of the Mark and Brian Show. My old radio colleague. We're going to just go down memory lane a little bit on Friday and see where it takes us. All right. With that, we're done. Thank you for listening, everyone. I'm way over. We went over because, you know, I figured we lost a few minutes in there. I'll edit it for the podcast. So the whole Dennis Kucinich interview fits nicely in that hour. But that's over with. And so now I will leave you with today's news. Here's what's news, and I'll see you tomorrow, everyone. I'm just fumfering until I get the button in the right place. Here we go. Bye.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
100% of my focus is on stopping this new administration.
That, of course, is Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader, the biggest obstruction to President Biden's agenda. But number two is a senator with a D next to his name. Joe Manchin of West Virginia wrote in the Charleston Gazette Mail on Sunday that he would not vote for SB 1, the For the People Act. That's the election reform law that Democrats are pushing to counter the voting restrictions passed in a number of Republican-controlled states. Without Manchin's vote in an evenly split 50-50 Senate, the bill will fail. Democrats in the White House have said that reform is necessary to preserve access to the ballot, particularly for voters of color who'd be most affected by these new state restrictions. Manchin said the bill is partisan and would, quote, risk further dividing and destroying the republic we swore to protect and defend as elected officials? Huh? And he doubled down on his opposition to changing or getting rid of the filibuster. Freshman Congressman Mondaire Jones of New York, a progressive Democrat, accused Manchin of voting, quote, to preserve Jim Crow. Meanwhile, the former guy continued to push disinformation around the 2020 presidential election in a speech Saturday before the North Carolina Republican Party. He praised states like Texas, Florida, and Georgia that have advanced laws making it harder for Americans to vote. He also, of course, criticized the Biden administration and Dr. Fauci. He demanded China pay $10 trillion for its role in the coronavirus pandemic and endorsed a guy named Bud for North Carolina's open Senate seat. Trump didn't say whether he plans to run for the White House again in 2024. And no, I won't be sharing any audio. If you must hear it, just go back and listen. It's the same lies he's been spewing since he lost the election and tried to blame you. Moving right along. The Biden administration is finally admitting that we are facing a national security crisis with increasingly more common ransom-demanding hackers. In recent weeks, they've targeted a pipeline, a Florida water system, schools, healthcare institutions, government agencies, and the meat industry. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm on Sunday said that U.S. adversaries are capable of shutting down our power grid. Many of the attacks appear to be the work of criminal gangs based in Russia. President Biden is set to meet with Russian President Putin this week on his first foreign trip since taking office, and the summit is likely to be even more tense than expected. Here at home, we begin another week with reports of another deadly weekend of shootings. In Chicago, at least 5 people were killed and 40 others wounded during 5 gun violence incidents. So far, no one is in custody. Salt Lake City and Indianapolis also saw reported fatal shootings over the weekend, while a shooting in New Orleans Sunday morning left 8 people injured. Miami was again prolific, with at least 2 mass shootings this weekend alone, following a spate of them over the Memorial Day weekend. Early Monday morning, 3 were killed and another 3 wounded in a murder-suicide in Homestead, Florida. It just never ends. More than 8,400 people have died from gun violence in the United States this year so far. Yet, despite those statistics, a U.S. District Court judge for the Southern District of California, Roger Benitez, on Friday overturned that state's assault weapons ban, which was put into place in 1989. Benitez called the ban a, quote, failed experiment, writing that, quote, government is not free to impose its own policy choices on American citizens where constitutional rights are concerned. Then he added that the law, quote, banned fairly ordinary, popular, modern rifles as opposed to just bazooka, howitzers, or machine guns. And then he described the AR-15 assault rifle as, quote, a perfect combination of home defense weapon and homeland defense equipment, and actually compared it to a Swiss Army knife. California Governor Gavin Newsom said the ruling is a, quote, direct threat to the public safety and the lives of innocent Californians, while the state's attorney general vowed to appeal it. Wow. Former White House counsel Don McGahn on Friday testified before the House Judiciary Committee about the former guy's efforts to undermine former special counsel Robert Mueller's federal probe of Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Committee Chair Jerry Nadler wouldn't discuss details about the interview, but he did say that McGahn, quote, testified at length to an extremely dangerous period in our nation's history, and that he was clearly distressed by Trump's refusal to listen to his legal advice. But with each day, we learn more about the excesses and illegalities of the Trump administration. The New York Times now reporting on newly uncovered emails showing that former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows sent then Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen several messages in late December 2020 and early January 21, asking him to examine baseless claims of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 elections, including one conspiracy theory described as, quote, fantastical, alleging that people in Italy used military technology and satellites to switch votes for former President Donald Trump to votes for President Biden. The messages highlight the increasingly urgent efforts by Trump and his allies to undermine the election results while he was still in office. Wow. Well, the Supreme Court's term officially ends on June 28th. That means the justices will deliver opinions from now until then, until they reach the end. And we're waiting on some biggies, including Fulton versus the City of Philadelphia regarding same-sex couples as foster parents, California versus Texas and Texas versus California. That's the third major challenge to the Affordable Care Act. Then there's a voting rights case that is Brnovich versus DNC and Arizona Republican Party versus DNC. There's a question about pay for college athletes in NC2A versus Alston and AAC versus Alston. Among the highest profile ones we'll be looking for Mondays and Thursdays at 10 a.m. Eastern until the end of the month. On Monday morning, the justices issued just one opinion, Sanchez versus Mayorkas. The opinion was unanimous, written by Justice Kagan, and the question was whether a grant of temporary protected status to the petitioner, Jose Santos Sanchez, given to him because of unsafe living conditions in El Salvador, enables him to obtain lawful permanent resident status despite his unlawful entry. The answer, according to all nine justices, is no. The justices on Monday morning also turned down a lawsuit alleging that America's all-male military draft amounts to unconstitutional discrimination on the basis of sex. There are still 22 cases yet to announce. The next opinions will come down Thursday. Stay tuned. And finally, Jeff Bezos, the billionaire owner of Amazon, The Washington Post, and founder of Blue Origin, announced in an Instagram post Monday morning that he and his brother will be among the first space tourists on the New Shepard when it takes flight on July 20th. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.